It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll find out what Wisconsin is tops in the nation in, besides cheese and cranberries.
First, when we think of big cities in the Midwest, it seems like we often view them as competing with one another, maybe over things like jobs or tourism dollars. But what if instead of competing, these cities focused on actually working together?
According to a new poll from the Marquette Law School, it's an idea that could have some legs. The poll surveyed residents in Milwaukee, Chicago, and Gary, Indiana, all major cities in a relatively small geographical area. It found that a majority of residents say that political leaders in all three states and cities should work together to promote economic development throughout the region instead of competing with each other. So what might this urban megalopolis actually look like?
Here with us now to talk about the findings is Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. He's also the co-founder of pollster.com and founder of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So digging into this latest poll, for the past few years, we've brought you on from time to time when Marquette gives us the latest polling numbers for various elections, other issues in state politics. This one's a bit different. Why did you want to assess attitudes on cooperation versus competition among these cities we're talking about?
Yes, no horse race results this time. 3 years ago, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is based in Paris, did a study of the region that includes the 21 counties from Ozaukee County, just north of Milwaukee, down through the Chicago area and along the northwestern Indiana shoreline of Lake Michigan. And they found that the region is one of the very largest economic metropolises in the world, but that economic growth has slowed down a bit here, and we're not keeping up with our peers to the extent that we were in the past. One of the things they pointed to was zero-sum competition between not just states but cities as well in this region, and that that was producing a limitation on our growth. One striking thing they pointed out is in these 21 counties, we have over 1,700 units of government. By comparison, the Toronto metro area, which is about the same population, has 28. So you can see why we might have a little trouble cooperating with one another when you have to get 1,700 different governments to sign off on anything. So that's the background. And 3 years ago, we did an initial study of this looking only in Wisconsin. This year, we studied all three states, 21 counties in the region, to see what public attitudes were. It's one thing to say you should cooperate, but if the public says, look out for my interests first, then political leaders certainly have no incentive to cooperate then.
So if we talk about this idea of a Chicago megacity, what would that look like if that were the case, if there were a Chicago megacity?
In one sense, there is already. You know, the Chicago economy affects all of us in the region. If you think of the new Amazon distribution center in Kenosha, this huge, over a million square feet facility doing lots of hiring, that wouldn't be here if Chicago wasn't nearby, right? And so the economic entity of this area exists. The issue is, how do we compete with one another? If you go to the Indiana border with Illinois, you'll see signs saying, move your business to Indiana. Famously, Wisconsin had signs, we're open for business. So the competition is absolutely normal, and in many ways, it's a good thing. We want competition there. But what we found in our survey was that voters said that they would like to see political leaders work together. They even actually surprised me. We said, would you agree that when it comes right down to it, the most important thing is how well things are going where I live? And actually, a majority disagreed with that and said they cared more about the region. So at least in lip service, there's a lot of support for cooperation. Now, it has real limits. This is not just Pollyannish support for cooperation. So when we asked, people said they'd be willing to see the state share money for transportation planning. But when we asked about business relocation and when we asked about tourism, majorities in all three states went the other way and said, no, the states should go their own way. So there you see the contrast between support for cooperation in areas where shared benefits are pretty clear, but opposition to cooperation when it's pretty clear that tourism dollars are going to be spent in Door County or they're going to be spent in downtown Chicago, but not in both, and therefore we're going to compete on that, not cooperate on that.
Well, looking again at this data, which does suggest an interest in cooperation, it caught my eye that it seemed as though Wisconsin had these high numbers that you also saw in Gary, Indiana, and Chicago, but often the Wisconsin numbers were a little bit lower. Do you make anything of that?
We were consistently anywhere from 5 to 10% lower than the others. Majorities in the three states were the same on just about everything we asked about. But majorities might be 60 or 62% on one. Wisconsin on that same item might be 54%, for example. So down a little bit. Not to switch the, you know, the direction, but the strength of support for cooperation was a little more circumspect here than it was in the other areas.
And what would this cooperation, do you think, look like? Do people besides those transportation dollars tell you how far they'd be willing to go?
I think it says that there are areas in which political leadership could find agreements. Another question we asked was whether state licenses for certain trades and professions like plumbing, cosmetology, real estate, nursing, should those licenses be common across the three states, or as it is now, each state with its own licenses? So if you want to work in another state, you have to get relicensed. Over 60% in Illinois and Indiana supported that. 54% in Wisconsin supported a common license. So that's a case where you don't see that one state wins and the other loses. Rather, workers throughout the region would be freer to take their trade across the border. And so there are collective gains there without any real clear individual losses. That, to some extent, holds with transportation. We'd like the highways to, you say, actually meet up at the border, you know, and for the train lines to go across the border correctly. So there's some shared benefits, too. But when you get to tourism and where a business is going to locate, it's pretty hard to share those benefits. And at that point, the public quite reasonably says, no, I'm not willing to go that far. So this is not unconstrained calls for regional cooperation. It's rather evidence that there is support for cooperation when it could make us all better off without advantaging one over the other. But we're going to certainly continue to compete on where that factory gets located.
We're talking right now with Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll, talking about results showing that people from Chicago, Milwaukee, Gary, Indiana, and those states support more cooperation, forming a sort of tri-state area. So for cities like Milwaukee and Gary, what are the advantages of hitching their wagon to Chicago when it seems as though Chicago maybe doesn't need them as much?
Well, I think there is a little more attention to Chicago from those of us that live in its shadow. I think one of the questions we asked is, do you see Chicago as a threat to drain talent and jobs, or do you see it as an economic opportunity by being close to it? And overwhelmingly, people said they did see it as an opportunity. That's where, you know, the spillover effects of being close to a great metropolis makes us all have greater opportunities, whether that's by locating a distribution center in Wisconsin that's going to serve the Chicago megacity, whether if you're in Indiana, it means a local commuter rail that can take you into jobs in the city. So it certainly is possible that people could see it as a threat, but in our data, mostly people see it as an opportunity, and that helps us all.
Well, I guess on the flip side, were you surprised that Chicago and Illinois in general didn't see these other cities, Milwaukee and Gary, as mooching off its success?
Well, there was no evidence of that. I suppose if we dug a little deeper, you might wonder about that. But the Chicago area is so huge compared to those of us to the north and the south. It's about 11.5 million people in the whole area. About 8 million of that is in the Chicago area. So we really are talking about, you know, this one huge center. To give you a thought experiment, imagine we took Milwaukee and plopped this down, I don't know, in the middle of Kansas, say, without Chicago nearby. We would still be a big and important city and metro region, but we wouldn't be able to profit from the fact that 90 miles south of us is one of the great cities of the country.
Now, Charles, with these survey results, do you have any particular recommendations to policymakers?
Well, I think the most important thing is that you're certainly going to compete over jobs, but there ought to be opportunities we see here that could make all of our citizens better off without differentially advantaging folks on the other side of the border. The licensing of professions is just one of those examples. So I do think there actually are some opportunities there that fall well short of just saying, let's give up our self-interest. Nobody is saying that in our survey, but there are these other opportunities that could be there. The one other thing we found in workforce development was how critical technical training for people with a high school diploma was. And that, too, is something that could benefit everyone if the three states made that kind of technical training more available to people with a high school diploma.
Well, Charles, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll. He joined us to talk about the school's latest poll on regional cooperation versus competition when it comes to economic development. Well, we know Wisconsin is at the top of the list when it comes to the nation's cheese, but there's got to be more, right? Well, our next guest did some digging and came up with five things in which Wisconsin is number one besides cheese and cranberries. Tom Giffey joins us now. He's the managing editor of Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what exactly were you digging for when you came up with this list?
Well, we're always looking for fun and enlightening statistics in this day and age that tell a good story about Wisconsin and about our region. And actually, we're working on a special issue on cheese, and I was delving a little bit into that. And the question that popped into my mind is we have to be number one in something other than cheese, which most people know. We lost that milk crown to California a while ago, and of course, some of us are still sore about that. And many of us know about cranberries, especially kind of up in our part of the state. But I found a really good report put out actually by the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, which has a plethora of statistics on these kinds of things. And I'm kind of a numbers geek, so it spoke to me. And I found some pretty interesting things.
All right, well, let's dive into some of these feel-good statistics about Wisconsin. So aside from cheese, what's number one on your list?
Milk goats popped out to me. Now, you know, you go to your co-op or your farmer's market, you're going to find goat milk cheese, but it turns out that we produce a lot of that stuff in our fair state, that we are number one in it. You're still not to the point where you're driving through the hills of Wisconsin, you see huge herds of milk goats. Maybe we're heading there. I don't know.
And goat milk has some things going for it over cow's milk, too, doesn't it?
Apparently, it is a little higher in protein and calcium, lower in sugar than cow milk. I think cow milk probably has some advantages itself, lest we hear from the dairy backers calling you with angry calls or leaving angry comments on our website.
All right, very good milk from goats and cows, for the
exactly.
record.
Exactly, we got to be diplomatic here.
All right, we'll go to the next item on your list, dry whey. Maybe not a big surprise given that this is a milk product, but what did you find there?
Yeah, that's something that we actually, about one-third of that product produced in the United States is made here in Wisconsin. As most of us know, so much of the milk we have is turned into cheese, but it's turned into either byproducts like this, which you look up dry whey and it's in just about everything, baby formula, baked goods, protein drinks and so forth. I think a lot of the things bodybuilders eat is pumped up with that dry whey coming from our good Wisconsin cows.
And do we know how much Wisconsin does produce of this stuff?
We're at 300 million pounds, according to DATCAP.
All right, it's a lot of whey right there. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so the next one did surprise me, mink pelts.
Yeah, and this is something that not without controversy, I guess. Looking at volume1.org, our website, we had some comments saying, well, why are you putting this on this kind of jokey little list? And, well, it's a statistic out there. Not everybody's happy with wearing fur, and a lot more people would say it's not particularly fashionable in the 21st century, but we have a lot of mink in this state. Something like one-third, again, of the minks in Wisconsin, or in the country, are here in this state. Over a million of them processed a year, so that's a lot of little critters.
And I'm going to skip over the next one. You're going to have to go to our Facebook page to find out what it is. A little teaser there.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there are certain words I probably can't say on the radio.
Well, we'll find out. Be careful. The next one, the last one on your list is, you tell us. What is it?
Well, we have beets is on the list.
Well, but what's number five?
Oh, number five. Sorry.
That's
I thought
you were
referring to that one. Cattle genetics exports. So essentially... where little calves come from. My dad grew up in this business, and when I was growing up, he worked in the artificial insemination business. So I know all about the frozen straws and the liquid nitrogen and the very long gloves. But that is actually a huge business. Anyone who's driven by the Madison area on the interstate knows the big billboard at APS, which used to stand for American Breeder Service, and they always have a good bull-themed pun out there on the interstate. So,
that's not one you're going to see on a T-shirt.
Probably not.
Not yet.
But it's something that we're proud of, and, you know, we living here in the city, like most of us do, we forget about all these great agricultural products sometimes, but it's important to remember that it is such a big part of our economy in Wisconsin.
Okay, it's been fun. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be on the show.
That was Tom Giffey, managing editor of Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire.
If you think there's something else Wisconsin should be known for, tweet us at Central Time WPR.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, yesterday the State Department of Natural Resources announced a reorganization. We'll talk to a WPR reporter about the details of the plan and what changes.
First, a look at the role of minority journalists in today's media landscape. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a researcher who asked the question, why aren't there more minority journalists?
First, a nonprofit multimedia news outlet geared toward Madison's communities of color is set to launch next month. The site will be called Madison 365. It'll cover topics like social issues, health, entertainment, and faith.
The site will join other news outlets aimed at minorities in Madison, like the Madison Times and Capital City Hughes, but creators say this platform will be a little different.
We're joined now by one of the site's co-creators, Henry Sanders Jr. Henry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, give us the origin story. Where did this idea for Madison 365 come from?
Well, you know, I think it came from a long time, a lot of conversations, but David Dahmer, who used to work for Madison Times, you just mentioned Madison Times, was leaving there. And him and I met, and we were talking about all the challenges that needed to happen in the community. And I said, well, you know, Dave, the thing that if you really want to reach communities of color, online is the way to go. All the data shows us that people of color use their iPhones more. They look for education more online. So that was the origin of starting the conversation of, Dave, you're free now. You want to move on, do something else. How can we be more impactful in the community?
And what kind of things do you want to cover? I mean, issues of race, issues facing minority communities in Madison and Dane County. They've been in the news, sometimes in national news, in the last couple of years. What are you tackling here?
Well, that's a really good question, Rob. I think when people get caught off guard when we're talking about we want to have our organization that's focused on people of color issues, but we want to focus on every issue that every mainstream media is focusing on, but we want to have it from a person of color perspective. We want to have journalists who are people of color who are writing about these stories and having it from a different point of view so we can not only educate the public what's going on, but also give a different voice to some of these conversations that are going on in our community today.
If those voices aren't out there in the media, mainstream or otherwise, what do you think we lose?
I think we lose a realistic, holistic perspective of what's really going on in the community. If we can't really solve problems, you can't really look for problems, you can't really look to help communities if you don't get the perspective from everyone who's involved. And in race, especially when it comes to race, there's not anyone who's not impacted by race in our community. So, I'm really excited about this. And one of the things I did learn while we're starting this organization up, there was no journalist of color. I mean, not one. So we literally started from scratch and find these young journalists who have this energy and this passion to want to give their voice. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, let's follow up on that issue. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to a national writer about minority journalists, the lack of minority journalists across the country. Do you see this project in part as maybe training a next generation of journalists who go on beyond Madison 365?
Absolutely. So Dave Dahmer is someone who has been in the community for a long time. He's a journalist, but he's a community journalist, right? So there's journalists who write, but there's people who understand how the community works, and that's a different skill set. So we're hoping to help these young writers learn how to do community writing and do more investigative journalism, and then hopefully they can go on and move on and do bigger things, but hopefully we can give them a platform to craft their talent, to hone their talent, and to also at the same time educate other people in our community what's going on and open the door for other writers to say it's possible to happen.
We're talking to Henry Sanders, Jr., co-founder of Madison 365, an online media source looking to serve and feature the writing of people of color in the Madison community. Now, Henry, have you seen things like this? Are you inspired by examples from elsewhere in the country, elsewhere in the state?
Well, when we're doing our research, first of all, we're taking a nonprofit tack to this, so we're not going for a pro-profit business. We're going more from a nonprofit. So, looking, there's not a lot of people of color magazines that are nonprofit. So, I mean, some of the ones you hear about are like Texas Tribune. Those are ones that we kind of look at their model, but there's not a lot. No, so there's not a lot of a model that we've actually looked for a people of color perspective, no.
And when we look at minority press, especially the African-American press, I mean, there's decades, actually centuries of history there. Are there things that inspire you from the past that you're going to try to capture, if not the form of, the spirit of on the new site?
Community. Someone who grew up here in Madison, I used to know every person of color in Madison growing up, and now the community is just more dispersed. There's no sense of community. So if we can really have this site be a place of dialogue and be a place of bringing people together, having community events, to have a sense of community and a sense of ownership of the community, and that's what we're hoping that this site can help do.
And speaking of community, you and your colleague have done some community forums to hear people's input about what you're trying to do. What kind of things did you learn from that process?
What I've learned is people are really excited for this product. I was caught off guard, the intensity and the happiness and the passion for people who are looking for something like this. And you know what people are really looking for? Looking for all the voices to be heard. I think right now our community feels sometimes there's only a few voices heard on certain issues, and we want everyone's voice to be heard. And you really hear from people that they want to keep people accountable. They want to make sure that we have something that brings people together, that we actually help build talent and give people opportunities and access to opportunities that they might not have had. So those are the things that really come, that's what you hear, those are the themes you hear over and over again.
Is this something that you hope is read by people not of color, by the white community in the area to help start conversations maybe that aren't happening right now?
Rob, if that doesn't happen, then we failed. I really believe if this is not a site that everyone comes to, that the whole community is not involved in and engaged in, we've failed. Because I believe it's an opportunity for everyone to look and learn about what's going on in colors, communities of color. And I think it's a place that we can educate people of color ourselves, but we also can educate the mainstream public. And it's a place that we can have real dialogue, right? One thing we always say, that our conversations are not going to be comfortable all the time, but they'll be honest and they'll be true. And out of that, hopefully we can actually solve some problems.
Well, take us behind the scenes. Most of us have never started a multimedia online news platform. Where are you now? What problems are you tackling to make this work?
Well, from a business perspective, Rob, we're just trying to get off the ground. We're trying to make sure that we have our writers in place. We're launching a Kickstarter campaign next week. We're also going to be launching the site next week. So right now, it's just the Bolton Notes, just trying to make sure we're getting the site up and running, getting the writers ready, you know, content editing. So that's the basic things right now we're doing.
Do you have a timeline in mind?
Yeah, well, again, we plan on doing our Kickstarter this week, and then we're planning on launching next week.
Oh, launching next week. Okay, so the way you described it, that sounded like a long process still to go. You're close to opening day.
Well, you know, when you're in this every day, it seems like a long process, but yes. but yes, we're ready to go. Right now, we're just trying to make sure our writers have a lot of content and the site's up and ready. So we're just going to start our Kickstarter and then hopefully raise some money off that. And then we'll launch next week.
So you've got these young journalists, people of color. You say they've got some content almost in the can now. A couple of headlines you're looking forward to putting up there next week.
Oh, that's a good question. So I know we're doing some stuff on I know we're doing some stuff on the Tony Robinson family and having a different perspective of from the Robinson side, talking about the people, kind of humanizing Tony, letting them know people know about who he was, what his friends are, what his friends thought about him in a situation. So we'll do some things about that. We'll do some faith stuff where we have a person who's asked the pastor. His faith is really big in communities of color. There's a mile in her scarf where it's talking about women issues. So we have lots of different things coming out, a lot.
Henry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Henry Sanders Jr., co-creator of Madison 365.
Coming up, we'll talk to our guest about minority journalism on a national level and get the answer to the question, why aren't there more minority journalists?
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you follow a minority-focused news source? Tell us about it. Do you wish there were more outlets like this or think there's a greater need for them? And why do you think members of minorities are underrepresented in the U.S. media? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're continuing our discussion on minority journalism, and you can join in. Do you get your news from a minority-focused publication? Do you wish there were more outlets like that, like the one we just heard about in Madison coming up? Do you think there need to be more minority reporters, journalists out there? Call now at 800-642-1234.
Our next guest set out to tackle the question, why aren't there more minority journalists? According to a piece he wrote for the Columbia Journalism Review, minority members were underrepresented in the media in research done decades ago, and the numbers haven't gone up a whole lot in the years since.
We're joined now by Alex Williams, doctoral student in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
So can you start by giving us a general snapshot of the state of minorities in journalism today?
Absolutely. So unfortunately, we know from industry surveys that newsrooms are still not very diverse. For example, last year, ethnic minorities accounted for 37% of the population in the United States, but only 13% of journalists at newspapers or in radio were minorities.
Now, some people might hear that and think, okay, I don't care who writes the story as long as they get it right. Why would a less minority representation, underrepresentation in the media be a bad thing?
So it's actually a really important issue because we know that this type of unequal staffing can lead to unequal coverage, which is especially important given the current political climate. And we also know that newsrooms actually have an economic incentive to have diverse newsrooms given the purchasing power of minorities, the opportunity to attract a larger, more diverse audience. For example, research from the Pew Research Center actually shows that minorities are more interested in local news and that they are more likely to share news stories on social media. Yet this lack of newsroom diversity is an issue that's persisted for decades.
So when we go to the newsrooms, to the editors, the people doing the hiring, what kind of things do they say to explain that gap?
So it's often been explained that there's kind of a pipeline issue. Editors have oftentimes complained that they would hire qualified candidates, but not enough qualified candidates are trying to enter journalism. So not enough minorities are going to journalism school and becoming qualified candidates.
And you checked out the numbers. Does that add up?
No, it doesn't. I actually looked at surveys of hundreds of schools from the University of Georgia, And the surveys track how many minorities are actually graduating from journalism and communication programs. And it's actually about 21% of graduates from these programs in the past 10 years have been minorities. So it's not a staggering number, but it's still significantly higher than the 13% of journalists that we see working in the newsrooms at newspapers and in radio.
So doing the math, it sounds like something is making it harder for those minority journalism school graduates to get jobs than their white peers.
Absolutely. You can actually break it down looking at what these students specialized in. So if you compare minority students that specialize in print journalism or broadcasting and compare them to their white counterparts, only 49% of minority graduates found a job within 6 to 12 months after graduating, compared to 66% of white graduates. So put another way, white graduates were 33% more likely to get a job than minority graduates.
You point toward maybe one economic explanation. One great way to get attention from a media employer is to do an unpaid internship. And people have pointed that to as an obstacle for minority members who are often maybe disproportionately less wealthy than their white peers. And other people said, hey, working class people, too, whatever race, may have a harder time because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So when companies rely on unpaid internships to find new candidates, they're disproportionately eliminating minority candidates or working class candidates because they're less likely to apply for unpaid internships.
We're talking to Alex Williams, journalism researcher, looking at minority underrepresentation in journalism. I want to get to a couple of our callers now. I want to take them back-to-back, I think. Evan is with us first in Oak Creek. Evan, hi.
Hey there.
What do you think?
I think that, there is a place for minority journalists, I don't think that the demand is nearly as high as you're guessing. Represented it, and I also don't know why that the existing journalist perspectives don't apply or are not as accepted to minorities as those of the opinions coming from minorities themselves. If I have a journalist on TV or a writer that's a minority, I don't necessarily find that their writing is not applicable to me just because I'm not a minority. So I'm really confused as to why they feel that the product put out there by non-minority journalists is not applicable.
I gotcha, Evan. Now I want to go to Anna in Evansville. Anna, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I'd like to say that I think it's very important that we have more minority news sources available. I come from a small town, and there aren't many news sources here other than, more mainstream ones. And I think it really comes down to when you are a person of color or a minority and all your news sources are, the same, they're usually white men, and there's not a problem with that, but representation is very important because when you're only hearing a perspective from a person who has privilege, you might not be able to identify with that as much, and it's just important to be inclusive of all people
All right, Anna, thanks a lot. I want to bring Alex Williams back in. Now, two different perspectives there, Alex, very, very different perspectives within the profession itself. How is that argument, that back and forth playing out?
So I think there is that natural tension. I think that most people understand that we're not saying that white journalists cannot cover diverse communities. I think the larger issue is that we know that in newsrooms you have to decide which stories to cover because you can't cover every story. And within those stories, you have to decide what are the most pertinent facts because you can't report every fact. And because of those conscious decisions, the more diverse the staff is, the better the product is because you get more perspectives, you get a wider selection of news stories, and you get different perspectives. And I think that ultimately benefits both diverse communities because they're better represented. But I also think it helps people that aren't a part of those communities better understand issues from a different perspective.
And Alex, as we wrap up, is this something that newsrooms, that employers are tackling and trying to change?
Absolutely. So the NPR Visuals team is actually accepting applications for internships this year, and they solicited applications, and they noticed a manager commented that he was disregarding a lot of applications because the cover letters were poorly written because they were focusing on why the candidate loved NPR so much. And he was saying that, you know, I don't want to read that. And somebody else spoke up and said, well, actually, I think that it's understandable that people are making that mistake. The only reason why people don't make that mistake is because they've been coached, because they have backgrounds of privilege. So they're actually making the process more transparent. They're asking people to reapply, and this time they're detailing what they're looking for in the cover letters and the types of interview questions that they are going to ask. And their goal, by taking those steps, is to kind of remove that layer of privilege to minimize the importance of coaching.
Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That was journalism researcher Alex Williams. He's been talking about his research on minority journalists being underrepresented in the media.